Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky here. It's the 13th day of October 2014. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home where you will find the beginnings of the newly redesigned Horn website, courtesy of the inimitable John Fox in Australia. At HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, of course, you will find access to the chat room and to the streams, the various forms of the stream, link to the podcast, and more functionality yet to come in the future. You'll also find the PayPal button. That's how we fund this whole operation. This is contributor-driven, contributor-supported. It is run by our community for our community. Now, in the ordinary course of events, we try to raise about $150 per evening. And I'm proud to say that despite missing two programs last week, we're square for tonight. And that is entirely thanks to Tosh and Brian and Diane and Teresa and Linda and Anthony, Frederick, Dennis, Kath, and Paul, and from Grand Point Enterprise and Irish Dave. All taken together, we cleared up the entire week, even though I was gone Thursday and Friday, and so we begin the week afresh and anew and in no hole. What a delight that is. So thank you one and all to everyone listed and to everyone who keeps this entire process going. Yeah, I'm back. It was a whirlwind tour of New York City. Flew up on Friday, and see, the way it works out is if you want anything other than, say, you know, one of those little knees to your chin air Keebler kind of affairs for your commuter aircraft out of Charleston, West Virginia, you've got an early flight. So that's why I was gone on Thursday, because I had to be down and asleep in order to get up and go Friday. So anyway, yeah, up and out and gone on a rainy Friday morning. It was kind of overcast-ish in New York by the time I arrived there. And I want to thank in particular the staff, the team, the crew, the production outfit there at All In with Chris Hayes for making me very, very welcome. There at Rockefeller Center, broadcast home of MSNBC. Thanks go out to Chris Hayes for inviting me on. We had a delightful, if short, you know, it's TV, it's all going to be short, conversation, and I hope that conversation will continue down the road. It was, and of course, any trip to New York is always amazing, no matter how short it may be. Thanks go out to Pterodactyl, Sarah for being my tour guide in the city that evening. Yeah, one of these days I'll get there and we'll have time for a full-on horn-in with all of the Horn family in the New York area who want to show up and hang out and whatever. But by the time the program was over, about 9 o'clock on Friday night, I was starved. And so Tara took charge, and I got an automobile tour of the nighttime streets of Manhattan, and she drove me down into the Lower East Side, what is it, Houston and Latimer Streets, the corner thereof, and a little joint called Katz's Deli. Oh, my God. What an experience. Nothing quite like it. Place has been open since 1888, so it is, you know, it's for real. And my gracious sakes, everything you could ever. I had a bowl of matzo ball soup, and the matzo ball is the size of a baseball, and delicious. And a half of a corned beef sandwich, and a half of a Nobelwurst. It's a garlic sausage sliced thin, on all of which was on this beautiful, beautiful rye bread that, magnificent. And Tara and I shared some latkes, and I had my first ever New York egg cream. It was wonderful. It's just wonderful. And the idea of that place being constantly in business since 1888. Wow. And they were walking around in the staff wearing T-shirts with what is apparently their old World War II or maybe World War I slogan on them. And I found it charming when I started thinking about it. Send a salami to your boy in the army. Which is an approximate rhyme at best. But then upon thinking about it a little bit, because I'm weird, upon thinking about it a little bit, I realized that, yeah, it's send a salami to your boy in the army is an approximate rhyme if you say it like that. If, however, you use the accent and dialect, if you use the local argot, is it a silent T because it's French? I don't know. But anyway, if you make it a silent R in army, it's a direct, perfect rhyme. Send a salami to your boy in the army. See? Salami, army. Yeah. And I love the music of hearing the accents and all the... Oh, New York is a... Well, it's a special place, especially for Southerners and hillbillies and whatnot. Had a great ride over from the airport into Midtown Manhattan. Looked over, coming across the Queensboro Bridge, at some really, really old buildings. They reminded me of what I'd seen, say, in D.C.'s Chinatown, and up on Capitol Hill. You know, that's architectural style that kind of says, oh, 1880, 1890. And immediately I started to, well, I love the movie Gangs of New York. I've been introduced to a new series that I'm excited to watch more of from Cinemax called The Nick, K-N-I-C-K, about people in New York at that basic roughly estimated time. And I'm looking forward to whiling away a couple of hours watching that. No, I still haven't found my way into Brooklyn. I have to find my way into Brooklyn at some point in time. I've been through Astoria, Queens. Haven't found my way to the Bronx yet. My favorite denizen of Brooklyn, of course, that Academy Award winning rabbit, because that's what went through my head. I looked down on all those old buildings, and I thought back to Bugs singing, "She was the daughter of Rosie O'Grady, a regular old-fashioned Khalil." Hey, look, I'm dancing. I'm simple. But most important of all, lest I get carried away, was the opportunity to tell more people about what's going on in Appalachia, mountaintop removal, the human rights, human health, and ecological disaster being perpetrated every day. Dr. Bill had a wonderful discussion earlier today of Thomas Jefferson's remarks regarding life being for the living. And I chimed in, and we talked a little bit about that, and all within the context, of course, of Columbus Day. I desperately want to see this country stop celebrating Columbus Day. It is odious in the extreme. Christopher Columbus, Cristobal Colon, was a brutal, egomaniacal, genocidal, homicidal, mercenary, criminal monster. And that's not just my opinion. His own words bear him out. And it is damned well about time that we stop celebrating genocide. Seriously. The state of West Virginia has, as a state holiday, in which is a paid day off for state workers in West Virginia, Columbus Day. Now, I've been a state worker, and it's not, and the pay is not great, and it's nice to have an acknowledged paid day off once in a while, and it's nice that there's one that comes in the fall. But do we not think that we have enough gumption to figure out some way to celebrate a fall holiday without celebrating genocide? Because that's what this is. And it was genocide from the beginning. The indigenous people who were living in the Bahamas when Columbus lived there, they pretty much wiped out. Lucayo, Taino. Yeah, Carol pointing out via Skype. I call today, "Give me your land or I'll kill you day." And that's largely true, save for the fact that they took the land and killed them anyway. I mean, I've got, and you can go wandering around and find all kinds of Christopher Columbus quotes, but here, let's have a few of the man's actual words, the man whose accomplishments, to wit, genocide, we celebrate today. Well, somebody may, I don't. "Your Highnesses, as Catholic Christians and princes who love the holy Christian faith and the propagation of it, and who are enemies to the sect of Muhammad," namely Muslims, "and to all idolatries and heresies, resolve to send me, Cristobal Colon, to the said parts of India to see the said princes, with a view that they might be converted to our holy faith. Thus, after having turned out all the Jews from your kingdoms and lordships, Your Highnesses gave orders to me that with a sufficient fleet I should go to the said parts of India. I shall forget sleep and shall work at the business of navigation so that the service is performed." That's kind of high-minded. Let's sail to India and convert people from their native religion to something we can maybe make a buck off of and claim that we're saving their souls. Unfortunately, and by the way, let's chuck something right out the window. In 1491, 1492, nobody was laboring under the impression that the world was flat. That's another thing Christopher Columbus did not do. He did not prove that the world was round. This had been known since the time of the ancient Greeks. What he thought, however, was that he could get a leg up on the Portuguese, you know, because money. That he could get a leg up on the Portuguese and find a different way to get to Asia faster by sailing west than east. And in this, he was wildly incorrect, because he was assuming that the world was considerably smaller than it is. But nonetheless, being an idiot and a genocidal maniac, when he landed on some islands that turned out to be in the new to him, world, he set about Christianizing them. This he did through several creative means, including murder, rape, mayhem, pillage, mutilation, maiming, in the name of Jesus, of course. There are actually some excerpts. Columbus wrote down his impressions of what it was like when he first met people who lived on this side of the planet. They brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears and many other things, which they exchanged for the glass beads and hawk's bells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They were well built, with good bodies and handsome features. They do not bear arms and do not know them, for I showed them a sword, and they took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance. They have no iron. Their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. That note apparently made it back to Spain, and Ferdinand and Isabella, a pair of racist, bigot, Christian zealots, thought, 50 men, what could we do with a couple of hundred, maybe 1,000? Let's get going. There's gold in them there hemisphere. And out of something that allegedly happened 600 years ago, 500 and some years ago, yesterday, arises a genocide the likes of which the world has never known to this day. The single most successfully populated quadrant portion of the globe was, in short order, depopulated through disease, warfare, avarice, religion, you name it. It was accomplished by the Spanish, by the Portuguese, by the Dutch, by the English, by the French. Anyone wanting to track a little bit of this, I recommend Charles C. Mann's 1491. It's one of those books I keep going back to time and time again. Millions and the most populous continents on the planet emptied, rubbed out. And this we celebrate by giving state workers a day off. Look. And to the Italian community, great respect. But could we convince you maybe to celebrate a worthwhile Italian about this time of year? You'll get no fight out of me over Leonardo da Vinci over Michelangelo. Mario Lanza, hell, who cares? Just not a genocidal, homicidal maniac, okay? Please. Knights of Columbus, you might want to rebrand. Because you may as well call yourselves the Knights of Genocide. I mean, really, what the hell's wrong with the Knights of Botticelli? Or the Knights, well, I mean, there were run-ins. How about the Knights of Medici? Yeah, I know. Issues. And the Borgias were kind of Spanish. Well, yeah. But no. Loads of magnificent Italians whom one might well revere. Far more so than Cristobal Colon. And not having quite so much reverence for Columbus is really nothing new. No. Because in The Innocents Abroad, Mark Twain takes on Mr. Columbus. Somewhere along the way, he says, that, you know, that they were touring Italy. And this portion also has a little bit of family history for us here. It's where my son got his nickname. Because once upon a time, my son was a little person whose name we didn't know. Mark Twain writes, "In this place, I may as well jot down a chapter concerning those necessary nuisances, European guides. Many a man has wished in his heart he could do without his guide, but knowing he could not, has wished he could get some amusement out of him as a remuneration for the affliction of his society. We accomplish this latter matter, and if our experience can be made useful to others, they are welcome to it. Guides know about enough English to tangle everything up so that a man can make neither head nor tail of it. They know their story by heart, the history of every statue, painting, cathedral, or other wonder they show you. They know it, and they tell it as a parrot would. And if you interrupt and throw them off the track, they have to go back, begin over, and begin over again. All their lives long, they are employed in showing strange things to foreigners and listening to their bursts of admiration. It is human nature to take delight in exciting admiration. It is what prompts children to say smart things and do absurd ones, and in other ways show off when company is present. It is what makes gossips turn out in rain and storm to go and be the first to tell a startling bit of news. Think, then, what a passion it becomes with a guide whose privilege it is every day to show to strangers wonders that throw them into perfect ecstasies of admiration. He gets so that he would not by any possibility live in a soberer atmosphere. After we discovered this, we never went into ecstasies anymore. We never admired anything. We never showed any but impassible faces and stupid indifference in the presence of the sublimest wonders a guide had to display. We had found their weak point. We have made good use of it ever since. We have made some of those people savage at times, but we have never lost our own serenity. The doctor asks the questions generally because he can keep his countenance and look more like an inspired idiot and throw more imbecility into the tone of his voice than any man that lives. It comes natural to him. The guides in Genoa are delighted to secure an American party because Americans so much wonder and deal so much in sentiment and emotion before any relic of Columbus. Our guide there fidgeted about as if he had swallowed a spring mattress. He was full of animation, full of impatience. He said, "Come with me, gentlemen. Come, I show you the letter writing by Christopher Colombo. Write it himself. Write it with his own hand. Come." He took us to the municipal palace. After much impressive fumbling of keys and opening of locks, the stained and aged document was spread before us. The guide's eyes sparkled. He danced about us and tapped the parchment with his finger. What I tell you, gentlemen, is it not so? See, handwriting Christopher Colombo. Write it himself. We looked indifferent, unconcerned. The doctor examined the document very deliberately during a painful pause. Then he said, without any show of interest, Ferguson, what'd you say was the name of the party who wrote this? Christopher Colombo! The great Christopher Colombo! Another deliberate examination. Did he write it himself, or how? He wrote it himself! Christopher Colombo! His own handwriting! Right by himself! Then the doctor laid the document down and said, why, I've seen boys in America only 14 years old that could write better than that. But this is the great Christopher! I don't care who it is. It's the worst writing I ever saw. Now, you mustn't think you can impose on us because we're strangers. We're not fools by a good deal. If you've got any specimens of penmanship of real merit, trot them out. And if you haven't, drive on. We drove on. The guide was considerably shaken up, but he made one more venture. He had something which he thought would overcome us. He said, ah, gentlemen, you come with me. I show you beautiful, oh, magnificent bust, Christopher Colombo. Splendid, grand, magnificent. He brought us before the beautiful bust, for it was beautiful, and sprang back and struck an attitude. Ah, look, gentlemen, beautiful, grand bust Christopher Colombo, beautiful bust, beautiful pedestal. The doctor put up his eyeglass, procured for such occasions. What did you say this gentleman's name was? Christopher Colombo, the great Christopher Colombo. Christopher Colombo, the great Christopher Colombo. Well, what did he do? Discover America! Discover America! Oh, the devil! Discover America. No, that statement will hardly wash. We are just from America ourselves. We heard nothing about it. Christopher Colombo, pleasant name. Is he dead? Oh, corpo di Bacco, 300 year! What did he die of?
I don't know. I cannot tell.
Smallpox, think?
I do not know, gentlemen. I do not know what he die of.
Measles, likely?
Maybe. I do not know. I think he die of some things.
Parents living?
Impossible!
Which is the bust and which the pedestal?
Santa Maria! This the bust! This the pedestal!
I see. Happy combination. Very happy combination indeed. Is this the first time the gentleman was ever on a bust? That joke was lost on the foreigner. Guides cannot master the subtleties of the American joke. So, you know, there you are. The late 19th century, and Mark Twain is refusing to participate in the Columbus cult. And by the way, I really am. I'm sending letters to various politicians, because I do that with my time sometimes, here in West Virginia, saying, listen, fellas, ladies, it's 2014, second decade, 21st century, we should have helium-filled pants and jetpacks by now, but one thing is for sure, even though we don't, we got to get rid of this Columbus business. And you know, by the way, while we're at it, Washington, D.C., out there in front of Union Station, one of the most obnoxious, revolting pieces of statuary I have ever seen in my entire existence, the Subjugation of the Americas by Christopher Columbus. I'm not saying, you know, like, go after it with a sledgehammer or anything, but just put it somewhere that people can see it if they want to, but don't have to see it all the time, though, you know, so that we can stop revering a freaking monster. Because he was one. Yes, he was absolutely a monster. But let's not make an assertion without supporting it, because while he was a monster, he was also a generous man. when he took off across the westward across the Atlantic Ocean, he styled himself the Lord Admiral. Man barely had a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of, but suddenly he was a Lord Admiral. And he had grown up with a fellow named Michele de Cuneo, da Cuneo. And as an act of, and they'd been buddies since childhood, and he was on the voyage. And so having gotten there, Columbus made a gift to Senor da Cuneo. He made him a gift of another human being. And Senor da Cuneo had, he had enough foresight to jot down the notes for posterity, you know. And he wrote, "While I was in the boat, I captured a very beautiful Carib woman, whom the said Lord Admiral gave to me." Gave her to him. Yeah, really. "When I had taken her to my cabin, she was naked, as was their custom. I was filled with a desire to take my pleasure with her and attempted to satisfy my desire. She was unwilling, and so treated me with her nails that I wished I had never begun. But, to cut a long story short, I then took a piece of rope and whipped her soundly, and she let forth such incredible screams that you would not have believed your ears. Eventually, we came to such terms, I assure you, that you would have thought that she had been brought up in a school for whores." That's what we're celebrating today. That's what people have the day off from work today for. Raping a woman and beating a woman until one would have thought she had been brought up in a school for whores. Columbus, Ohio might want to rethink its name, too. Suggestions are, I'm open to suggestions. Columbus, Georgia, you too. I think there's a Columbus, Mississippi. Little tour guide information coming in from Carol. She says, "Manhattan was my home for 18 years, and it's a great place. Forget Queens. You'd love Brooklyn." And that's another thing. When we left Kansas Deli, we looped on around down and came to the bottom of and went up the west side, you know, the Hudson River side. And never having seen the Hudson River, I was rather astonished to see that it was right wide. And you know what a history nerd I am. I looked out across it to the winking lights of Hoboken.
Hoboken? Ooh, I'm dying again!
I learned all about New York from Bugs Bunny. Don't blame me.
But it's a long way. It's a long way from the west coast of Manhattan Island to the New Jersey mainland. And I'm not talking about it's a long way by car, because by this time I'm traveling in time. Sherman has set the Wayback Machine for the early days of the 19th century. And I'm looking at that expanse from the west side of Manhattan Island, which at that point in time, the time that I'm thinking about, was not fully developed, was not, you know, it wasn't just one great big concrete island with a little green spot in the middle. No, it was mostly, there was farmland. And Murray Hill really was a hill, which is not on the west side, I understand. But anyway, just an example. Harlem was a Dutch enclave named after a place in the Netherlands. But no, by the early years of the 19th century, the practice known as dueling had been criminalized in New York, in the state of New York. Because the young republic was going to try to manifest some semblance of sanity. But dueling had not been outlawed, and sometimes one wonders if it ever has been, in Jersey. And so it was in the early pre-dawn hours, which is kind of smack dab in the middle of the night, a couple of rowboats. Freaking rowboats! Those of you familiar with the geography will understand my when the light went on and it dawned on me. Rowboats took off from the west side of Manhattan Island and whoosh, 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 went rowing across the Hudson River to Weehawken. And what was at the time referred to as the plains of Weehawken. I think it's just a warehouse now. In the boat is a guy and his second and somebody rowing the boat. There's another boat doing the same thing with the same contingent. The two principals are Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. Aaron Burr is the vice president of the Young United States under Thomas Jefferson. Alexander Hamilton has been one of the principal architects of the Constitution that created the country of which Aaron Burr was the vice president. He was Secretary of the Treasury under Washington. He was a Federalist through and through. If you are familiar with Dr. Bill's work, he has gone to great lengths to explain what Hamilton's positions were relative to the formation of the new nation. He spoke for 6 hours at one point in a gathering to consider the merits of the new Constitution. And he and Aaron Burr didn't like each other. You know how this ends. And their dislike for each other grew to such a fever pitch that at some point in time, Alexander Hamilton said something so awful about Aaron Burr that Aaron Burr felt he had no choice but to call out Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton could have avoided the duel by withdrawing his charge. But Alexander Hamilton would not withdraw the charge. Dueling was illegal in New York, but not so in New Jersey. A mere rowboat ride across the Hudson freaking river away. It's before dawn. It's the dark and still of the night. And two rowboats set out across the Hudson River. And just driving along, I'm looking at the width of the Hudson River. And I looked at Tara and I said, for God's sake, that's a big river. How do you not get in the rowboat and go, you know, we might not even live to see the duel. We could get swamped. We could get drowned. The guy rowing the boat could get all tired out. Let's work this out. But no, they both made it to the other side. Hamilton, perhaps feeling that he was in fact in the wrong, and yet unable to back down, missed. Aaron Burr didn't miss. Aaron Burr was by far the better lawyer of the two. He had a very substantial and very successful law practice in New York. But he had to take it on the lam after that, because there were those who said that he was a murderer. And there are no small number of American mysteries But that remains one of the greatest. What did Alexander Hamilton say about Aaron Burr that made that whole thing happen? Now, later on, Aaron Burr would be hunted down, and Jefferson would bring great shame upon himself by trying to see him dead. Jefferson never really forgave Burr for forcing the House of Representatives to vote on no small number of ballots to determine who would be president following John Adams. But we do not know to this day what it was. And using our 21st century cultural biases and mindsets, we can't help but wonder. What would be so awful? Now, Aaron Burr had only one child, a daughter, Theodosia. He had raised her and educated her as if she were male. He had refused to bow to the standards of the time and keep his daughter beautiful but ignorant. Gore Vidal, in his novel Burr, speculates that Alexander Hamilton had said that, had alleged that Aaron Burr was having sex with his own daughter. Because one supposes that in considering all these things and the acrimony that passed between the two, that that was the only thing that Gore Vidal, who was no slouch as a scholar, could come up with to answer the question of what would possibly be so awful as to engender that much vitriol. It is a mystery that remains a mystery to this day. Burr was not an easy man to comprehend. It is uncertain to this day whether he actually did think that he was going to go across the Ouachita River and set up some sort of new American kingdom that had its sights set on overthrowing Mexico. Oddly enough, the idea that was ascribed to Aaron Burr would be put into play in fairly short order, with the young United States going down and, in fact, overthrowing the government of Mexico, whose constitution was older than our own. So that's the kind of thing that was going through my head as we rolled up the river. Up the river, Hudson River side of Manhattan Island. We drove past the USS Intrepid, and I thought of my father. The Intrepid is an Essex-class carrier. In other words, she is of a class of carrier that is named after the first of such, which was the carrier my father served on in the Second World War. It's a big ship. It's tiny, however, by comparison to the modern class of nuclear aircraft carriers. But it was big enough to be hit by a kamikaze, the Essex was. And I got to thinking how I would love to go back there, go back to New York. I would like to, because I'm a man of sentiment. I'd love to go back and go aboard the USS Intrepid on November the 25th of this year. I'd like to see the boiler room, and I'd like to go to that place on deck where my father sat on November the 25th, 1944, on a ship designed exactly as the Intrepid is. It was November the 25th, 1944, that a kamikaze slammed into the very spot my father had been sitting in until he had gotten up to leave and go to the head before he had to go back on duty. His buddy stayed behind and was incinerated in the explosion.
If you look up USS Essex kamikaze attack, November 1944, there's lots of photos. 70 years ago, on November the 25th of this year, little tiny specks, tinier than sand grains in time, that change everything. These are the things that go around in my mind as I run round and about the various places I go. Now, this is, so all of that, by way of just giving you a little sense of what went on while I was gone. You know, because I think about you guys, too. And all the goodwill that went with me. And I really do appreciate it. Thanks for all the Facebook likes and the tweets. Your response to the appearance on All In with Chris Hayes was profound. And thanks to you for helping spread the word around about that series, All In America Coal Country. Because they told me when I got there that they had had a tremendous response to the series. And were most effusive in thanking me for helping them pull it together. It was a thrill of a lifetime. A note came in from our buddy Rochelle. She says, congratulations on dominating international media. I'm sure Rockefeller Center never knew what hit it. Thanks, Rochelle. And we will, in fact, and this kind of goes hand in glove with some of the impressions I had coming away from my trip to New York, namely that was a tremendous effort that was made by the All In crew to pull together a really good week-long picture of the modern reality of coal. And I got to wondering, wouldn't it be cool to have not just segments in a program, but a program itself that focused on the grassroots struggles of people, not just in this country, but in this hemisphere and in the world, to protect themselves against the predatory conduct of the extraction industries, whether it be coal in West Virginia or fracking in Pennsylvania or Ohio or Texas, or tar sands in Alberta or Utah or Alabama, iron ore in Wisconsin, frack sands mining in Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota. All the various mining horrors being unleashed in the global South, South America, South Africa. Yes, one's a country, one's a continent. Don't think I don't know. Rochelle points out, she says, I imagine you've seen the news, and I have, about the federal government approving the Cove Point export terminal. Of course, this is far, far from the end of the story. And she points me toward independent journalist Ann Metter, who has covered it fairly extensively. She and John Zangas go to dcmediagroup.us for the coverage. And Rochelle suggests that we have Ann Metter on the program sometime soon. And I think that's a very good idea. Yes, indeed. Kate with a note. Subject line, welcome back. You've been ruined. Lost your egg cream virginity. Too bad you couldn't have brought home a hot pretzel from the airport. My fondest memories of my life in Brooklyn and Queens is the food. Oh, the food, the food, the food. And everywhere you looked. Brazilian. We walked through a place that apparently is known as Little Brazil. And walked, you know,
just, you know, there on the, because you know, it's New York, you know, you, and I'm, you know, gape mouth, wide eyed little, you know, little hillbilly, you know, country mouse come to the city going, God damn, it's a French restaurant. Well, yeah, Bob, it's a French restaurant. It's New York. We have French restaurants. Yeah, it was magic. It was a brief but magic time. So, just a, well, an amazing time. So that's kind of a trip update, but don't think for a minute Carol pointing out, it has been speculated regarding Burr and Hamilton. It has been speculated that Burr said that Hamilton was a dangerous man who ought not be trusted with the reins of government. Only one problem there. Burr called Hamilton out for something Hamilton said. Hamilton was running around calling, we know this much, that he was referring to Burr as a Cataline. And if you had a privileged education, and Burr and Hamilton damn sure had a privileged education. It was Burr, who was a classmate of little Jimmy Madison's at Princeton. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Burr who introduced James Madison to his future wife, Dolly. Yeah. And so they were schooled in the classics. And to call someone a Cataline was a gentlemanly way of saying that someone was a traitor. So that may be what it was, but there is no certain knowledge. It's about 8 minutes before the hour. Thanks to Carol. Thanks to Carol for getting us started on fundraising for this evening. Very much appreciated, Carol, a recent addition to the News Ninja team at the Horn. If you want to help us take care of fundraising for the evening, head on radionetwork.com, the PayPal page, the contributions page, works just dandy. But travel report notwithstanding, make no mistake, I know, oh Lord, don't I know what day today is. And I wasn't going to forget. Oh no.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up, step right up. You will not believe your ears. You will not believe your senses. You will believe that your senses have, in fact, betrayed you at the parade of, at the display of Morans here on Monday, Moran Monday on the Horn. Yes, indeed, for less than 5 cents per hour of programming, you can peer behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas and behold Morans of all varieties. Morans. That's right. Morans of the right-wing variety. Right-wing Morans, Repiglican Morans, John Bircher Morans, Birchers, Birthers, Deathers, Tenthers, Booger Eater Morans, Libertarians, Morans of all variety. This, you can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. Head for the hills or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans.
Yeah, it's Moran Monday on the Horn, all right. And we got lots of Morans to deal with. Philip Obster notwithstanding. Oh, mercy sakes, we do. Let's start close to home, shall we? Yeah, why not? A little revelation coming out of the court system of West Bicol, Virginia these last few days.
Turns out that all that testing, all those job-killing regulations, Carol reminded me of this, all those job-killing regulations that the right wing loves to complain about. Yeah. They don't amount to much if you're actually dummying up the results of the testing required by the regulations. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, this is just precious. A man has pled guilty in federal court in West Virginia to faking up water testing results for the coal industry. Really? Who'd have thunk? Salon has the story, based on a story out of the Charleston Gazette. John W. Shelton was a field technician and later a supervisor for Appalachian Laboratories, Inc. Yeah. And he has recently admitted in a court of law that he dummied up the water samples. Ken Ward Jr., of course, has the report at WVGazette.com if you want to go and read it. I don't know what we got to do to get Ken Ward Jr. a Pulitzer, but we haven't apparently done enough of it yet. John Shelton is from Raleigh County, West Virginia, which is just one county south of me. And he didn't just dummy up the water quality results and samples once. He did it repeatedly. John W. Shelton is 47 years old, and he has pled guilty to a charge of conspiracy to violate the Clean Water Act, which, of course, we all know that all West Virginians hate, because the Clean Water Act is just a way for, it's a way for that Obama to wage his war on coal, right? Of course. There's lots of juicy little tidbits in this story of this moron, and he would be of the criminal variety, the dangerous variety. Just think of all the people he helped poison so that he could make get a paycheck. But that's the nature of the coal industry in Central Appalachia. They pay the way they do, and they're the best-paying jobs in America. That's what the coal industry likes to say. And the reason you have to pay so much is you have to pay a lot of money to people to get them to co-opt into your system by which they make a lot of money by poisoning other people. Understand, please, that every single worker on every single mountaintop removal site in Appalachia is being paid to poison his neighbors. I say his and not hers because there just aren't a lot of women working in mountaintop removal. Some, but not a lot. John W. Shelton admitted that he diluted water samples, substituted water he knew to be clean for actual mining discharges, and did not keep water samples refrigerated, as is required by state and federal rules. Ken Ward Jr. reports. Here's the funny part. If John W. Shelton had done this in connection with urine samples for a college football team, the college football team would probably be on probation. Maybe not playing anymore. Maybe kept from going to a bowl game or appearing on the TV and getting all the money that comes from it. But no, John W. Nothing's going to happen to the coal industry. But one of the little nuggets here is that Appalachian Laboratories, Inc. was an officially approved laboratory for testing purposes as declared by the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. Really?
this is, dig how long this happened. According to the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of West Virginia, John Shelton took part in a conspiracy. Now, see, that's one of the fun words in the article. That means there was more than one person involved. It wasn't just John W. Shelton, age 47, of Daniels, West Virginia. It was John W. Shelton, age 47, of Daniels, West Virginia, and at least one other person and probably several. And it went on from the time he was hired in 2008 through at least June 2013. That's 5 years of poisonous water. He would actually replace poisonous coal mine water with clean, clear water and say, hey, look, everything's just fine right here. Well, I tell you what, coal keeps lights on. You know that? It does. I mean, it's the engine of the economy of Appalachian, and look what good people they are. They don't even pollute the water. Mm-hmm. One hopes that this will be the first in a string of indictments. Actually, I think this was by information. In other words, the feds said, hey, we got you. And John W. Shelton, age 47, said, yep, you do. Where to assign? According to the information, the criminal information filed in federal court, the objects of the conspiracy were to increase the profitability of Appalachian Laboratories, Inc. by avoiding certain costs associated with full compliance with the Clean Water Act and to maintain and increase its revenue by providing its customers and the agencies regulating those customers with reports purporting to show that those customers were operating their sites in compliance with the Clean Water Act and thereby allow those customers to avoid fines and other costs associated with bringing their operations into compliance with the CWA and thus encourage and maintain for Appalachian the patronage of those customers. In other words, because money. Because capitalism. He was instructed by someone referred to in the information as a first known person to pull good samples. What that meant, pull good samples, didn't mean to appropriately and scientifically sample the water that they were being paid to sample. It meant instead that the samples that were sampled would, and we would know this beforehand, be in full compliance with the Clean Water Act. In other words, they would be dummied up. So they might get some water from a mine site, and they pour some distilled water into it to dilute it. And then you test it, and you go, well, hell, ain't hardly any poisons in here at all. One would be surprised to find poisons in distilled water, wouldn't one? Yes. They also knew, according to the information, the workers at Appalachian Laboratories, Inc., approved of by the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, they also knew of places that they referred to as honey holes. Honey holes, yeah. And that meant little places where the water was always going to be clean and never toxic or, actual water coming off the mine that could get the company fined for poisoning people's water, you know, the water of the people of the state of West Virginia. That's our water. Oh, actually, though, if you read the Clean Water Act, it's the water of, because you're involved, it's the water of the people of the United States of America, you know, in order to form a more perfect union, achieve domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense. That we the people. The two parties to the criminal action agreed and stipulated, quote, each time that Shelton and others at Appalachian diluted the sample water or replaced the sample water with water that would pass, They allowed water that they believed exceeded permit limits to discharge into the waters of the United States. John W. Shelton, age 47, of Daniels, West Virginia, faces sentencing on February 26, 2015. He's out on bail for participating in a conspiracy to poison the waters of people downstream from these mines and of the waters of the people of the United States. He faces up to a $250,000 fine, which will not be imposed. And he could be imprisoned in the federal system for up to 5 years. Now, the question obtains as to what degree he will maintain what is referred to in other eleemosynary organizations as omerta. Silence. Yeah, it's me and him. Yeah, we done it. You ain't going to say nothing about who told us to do it, are you? Mm-mm. I ain't stupid. You? Mm-mm. U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin said the investigation will continue. The FBI and the job-killing EPA is involved with this. Of course, you won't see any press releases coming from Shelley Moore Capito about this, or probably not Natalie Tennant either, because the EPA's a killing West Virginia because that Obama, he don't like West Virginia. He's trying to kill us. Mm-hmm. David McLean is the special agent for EPA's Regional Criminal Enforcement Program, and he said that what Shelton did and demonstrates that laboratories and their senior managers who callously place the American people at risk by submitting false reports will be held accountable. That's what the plea is, the guilty plea. Here's how pervasive it is. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Appalachian Laboratories, Inc., which is apparently still doing business, performs water sampling for over 100 different mine sites in West Virginia. Here's the fun part. None of the information in this particular criminal case tells which mine sites were dummying up the results, which means that anybody downstream of those 100 mine sites could be the ones who got poisoned. See how it works? Yeah. Those job-killing regulations really can't kill jobs if they're not being pursued, can they? As Ken Ward Jr. points out, back in 2008, it turned out that the West Virginia Department of Environmental... I just can't say protection. It turned out that they had gone about 5 years without monitoring discharge reports that Massey Energy, you know, headed at the time by one Don Blankenship, had been submitting to them. And then in Kentucky, the top three mountaintop removal companies there had been filing the same reports month by month by month and had never been called on it. And then this little punchline at the bottom of Ken Ward's story. Kelly Gillenwater, a spokeswoman for the DEP, said the agency gave federal investigators all the results it had from water sampling performed by Appalachian Laboratories. We haven't at this time conducted any additional testing at those sites because of these allegations, but have continued with our routine field sampling. Routine. Is that what we're calling it now? Imagine that. The coal industry steals. The coal industry poisons. The coal industry kills. And now we find out that it lies and cheats, too. Well, I'll be dipped. Ain't it just charming? Then, of course, Because Moran Monday is not limited to the new United States of America. Oh, no. This Moran Monday nomination comes from our buddy Robert in Australia. And it engenders in me the question, come on, really, Australia? You're going to let this guy stay in office? From the AAP, Prime Minister Tony Abbott, now remember, this is a guy who says that global warming is a hoax. Prime Minister Tony Abbott has declared that coal is good for humanity at the opening of new Queensland mine, talking up the resource's future after China's shocking decision to impose a tariff on Australian coal. You remember back, what was it, a week ago today when Cecil Roberts, the president of the United Mine Workers of America, said, well, if China's going to keep on using coal, we might as well keep mining it to send to China. They're not going to stop using it. Guess what? They're trying. The Chinese have imposed a tariff on Australian coal. Because the Chinese recognize the fact that they are, in fact, poisoning themselves. It's very important that we sustain our faith in coal, Mr. Abbott told BHP workers and dignitaries gathered for the official opening of the Cavill Ridge mine southwest of Moranbah on Monday. No, really. The mine is southwest of Moranbah. Do not doubt the powers of the goddess of irony. Moranbah. Coal is vital for the future energy needs of the world. Energy is critical if the world is to continue to grow and prosper. So let's have no demonization of coal. Coal is good for humanity. Coal is good for prosperity. Coal is an essential part of our economic future here in Australia. Oops. One note in the story, the Cavill Ridge mine near Moranbah has attracted criticism over its 100% fly-in, fly-out workforce of over 500 drawn from Brisbane and Cairns. Cairns, Robert, you want to help here? Fly-in, fly-out workforce means that they're just flown into the site and flown out of the site. They do their shift, whatever. Because, well, you wouldn't want local people working on the jobs, but, well, local people don't need to be working those jobs anyway, because it's poisonous. Let's have no demonization of coal. No, Tony, piss off. Coal doesn't have to be demonized. Coal is pre-demonized for our inconvenience. What's got Tony's knickers in a twist is that China is putting a 3% levy on coking coal and a 6% levy on lower-grade thermal coal in order to boost its own local industry. At the same time, wind and solar are growing faster in China than just about anywhere else in the world. Because China doesn't have much of a choice. Because even though they are the most populous planet on Earth, they can't afford to sicken and kill off a significant chunk of their population by continuing to burn this filth. But Tony Abbott wants to poison more communities in his own country. I guess he thinks that there's some sort of bubble around the Cavill Ridge mine southwest of Maramba. And that there's nothing downstream and nothing downwind of that operation. Let's put aside my silly Australian accent attempt. Coal is good for humanity, you filthy, rotten, dirty, stinking liar. Coal is not good for humanity. Coal is toxic to humanity. Coal is smack dab in the middle of being the argument for the possibility that there won't be no humanity in fairly short order. Coal is good for prosperity. Bullshit. I'll bet you if you did an actual economic analysis of the coal industry in Australia, it would show up just like the coal industry in the United States and cost people a hell of a lot more money going out than coming in. Because they never measure the externalities. Coal is an essential part of our economic future here in Australia. If coal, Tony Abbott, is an essential part of your economic future in Australia, you have no future, economic or otherwise. And on top of it all, the hubris involved with, so let's have no demonization of coal. So what? What kind of world leader says that he's essentially going to stick his fingers in his ears and yell, "La la 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 la! I can't hear you!" when people try to tell him what he is doing to the planet. See, that's the thing with the deniers. If they were only harming themselves, we would say, well, they're engaging in a little self-harm there, but they're poisoning and killing the rest of us. But apparently the Cavill Ridge mine southwest of Maramba, I don't know, is that remote? I don't have time to look it up. Is that remote? Because they're fly-in, fly-out workforce. It's probably just a little skeleton town there. So nobody's really going to be able to come out there and protest at the site. How about Canberra? Are there big coal protests in Canberra? I mean, I know there is a vital and viable and energetic climate movement in Australia. And in many ways, you know, the same stock of which the Australian people are made is the same cranky stock of which Appalachia is comprised. That's just nuts. Whew. 18 minutes past the hour of 7 p.m. We're on our way to the halfway point of the evening. And, of course, you can bring your own morans to the table. If you've got nominees. I got lots more nominees. And they're not all coal, but I just sort of wanted to start there since. Well, kind of picks up where we left off vis-a-vis Friday. You know what I mean. But by no means does that mean that we're limited to, you know, in environmental stuff? Sorry, looking for some stuff and casting about here. So it's time to, and this may not be perfect, I admit, this may not be perfect, but we're going to find out. It is time to note that, yes, as I promised, upon arriving home, I got the new little gizmo in line. The new phone gizmo. And it's all hooked up and ready to go. And we have ourselves a non-Skype means of reaching the program. Yay, us! Yay, you. You're the ones who made it happen. You're the ones who provided the funds to purchase the gizmo. And it's in line, and it's hooked up, and I've tested it briefly. So here's the new number. Write it down. I'm proud of it. Area code 304-663-HORN. Isn't that cute? Really, area code 304-663-HORN, H-O-R-N. Area code 304-663-4676. And you can get right through the program, and I think the audio will be okay, and I think we'll have, and this means we've got an open phone line for Friday on the front porch for people to participate with who can't otherwise participate via Skype. Cool, huh? Yeah. So we will put that, I hope, to good use later in the evening, and we'll test it out and find out. And we'll, you know, so, I don't know. Gee, I wish there was a prize to give away or something for first caller to the new horn gizmo. You know, we can add a second phone line as if we put in a second gizmo. As long as I got channels on the board, we can, yeah. But anyway, and here's what's cool. When we travel, do remotes and stuff, this can go with us. It's very portable. It's very nice. So there's that. 304-663-HORN, 663-4676 is the brand new gizmo horn phone. Well, they wouldn't let me have 666. The exchange around here is 663. Waggy, I mean. But at any rate, we will try that out in short order. We're going to take a break right now, however, because I've been filibobstering for nearly an hour and a half. You're listening to Conversation Radio, progressive, liberal, uncensored, fearless. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
How can we dance when our earth is burning?
Yeah, midnight oil, and beds are burning. They couldn't resist under the circumstances. It was just, well, I guess a little too obvious. But anyway, this is Moran Monday on the Horn. And, by the way, we'll go to the phones in just a moment. See, I can say phones again. We got two options. We got the Skype, which is 304-574-8178, or Bob Kincaid Horn, Skype to Skype. And we've got the new Gizmo line. It is 304-663-HORN. We have folks on hold on both, and I'm excited. That's really, really cool. But before going to the phones, in conjunction with the whole guy who stole the land day, I do want to offer both Portland public schools in Portland, Oregon, and I think schools in Washington State are now observing this day as Indigenous Peoples Day. Hey, I like that even better. And using the day to teach a little bit about what exactly happened to the Native peoples as a result of the European incursion onto this continent. And along the lines of that, our buddy Michael from Madison pointing out, white people, oh my God, we got to close our borders so the people with Ebola don't infect us. Native Americans, it's Columbus Day, LOL. Yeah. All right, let's try this thing out. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Okay, we'll get this yet. Hang on. Oh, okay. Just a second. Wait a minute. Got to get the connection in there. All right, we're connected.
Well, I wish I had some connections.
Well, there you are, Bill. What's happening?
Oh, man, this was interesting. Hey, you were... I wish I had been able to watch the TV stuff, but they charge you... I can't give up an arm and a leg for cable in this building, and that's what they want for it. On the west side, I was getting cable for free, but oh, well, you can't have everything, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Hey, you were hot tonight. Whatever happened to Burr?
Burr lived... Well, he lived through the attack by Jefferson. Jefferson tried to have him hanged.
Okay.
And he was acquitted at trial. And he went on, I think he lived in, his only daughter died in a shipwreck. She married some sort of plantation owner in South Carolina Stan, and they were lost off the coast somewhere on the way there. He went to Italy and lived for a while, but he came back and finished a long, prosperous legal career as a lawyer in New York City.
Okay.
I think he died maybe in the late I think he died in like the late 1830s.
Jeez, he did go a long time, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because I never heard whatever happened to the guy after the but Hamilton, what did you think of Hamilton? What's your opinion of what he was trying to do?
I used to not think much of Hamilton, but my opinion has changed thanks to the learning that Dr. Bill has made available. He, like all of those founders, was a very complex man. And his idea of the necessity of a federal government kind of makes sense to me.
Well, I know didn't he come here from Jamaica or someplace like that?
Yeah, Jamaica, Barbados. He was the bastard son of some planter down there, I think.
Yeah, those guys were good at that, weren't they? Producing offspring.
Well, if we were to believe the journals of the people who were with Columbus, they didn't. Let's put it this way: no means no hadn't dawned on them yet.
Yeah. Well, I will say this about Columbus. You're totally correct in your assessment of him as a navigator and as a person. He was a schmuck, no doubt about it. To use a little foreign touch there, a little ethnic touch. And what can you do? You know, what can you say? I mean, the best thing about him was the, you know how it was in this country with lodges, Bob. You know how big lodges were
in
this country? And the Protestant, what was the big Protestant brotherhood that, in fact, guys would meet on the Civil War of a wounded, what was that? The big, they came out of Europe, this fraternal organization.
What, the Masons?
Masons, yes, thank you. Yeah. Because a Catholic was not allowed to join the Masons, so they started, unfortunately, an organization called the Knights of Columbus. They should change that, too, huh? Because they have their personal, a lot of the personal things they did was a lot of charitable organizations in the big cities and, you know, that kind of thing. But couldn't they call it something? Yeah, but it's the Knights of Columbus.
Well, but see, what Mark Twain is pointing to in The Innocents Abroad is that, you know, there had been a cult, you know, in the 19th century, a sort of cult of Columbus rose up. And it was created largely in the Italian community because Italian immigrants were being so severely discriminated against.
Yeah.
And so that part's understandable. But my argument, Bill, is that, you know, now that, you know, when we learn things, we correct mistakes, right? When we learn we're making mistakes, we correct them.
I would say it's only recently in the last, at the most 50 years, that the truth about Columbus has been spoken of and people got a chance to learn about it, you know?
I, what
he was in reality.
Well, Howard Zinn did more than anybody else, I think, to open up people to that reality in people's history of the United States.
Yes, that tremendous work, yes. I haven't read it in a long, long time. I wish I could get it on audio. But that's the problem. So much stuff I cannot get on audio. So, you know, bingo. You move. So I'm taking two or three books into the... What used to be the Society for the Blind, now it's the Sight Center. And this is the thing, well, I'm not totally gone, you know. It's just I have to use... I have to make my computer very large with a program that does it. And in fact, I got one sitting here, and I can't seem to get anybody to come down to help finish it off because everybody in the clan is tied up with something, and I understand that, you know. And you can't hardly hire anybody to come in and work on the stuff anymore because there's not a lot of money like there once was in the computer repair business. It's buy another one, you know. So I built them in the early 90s, I was building the darn thing, assembling them, you know, because it was pretty easy work. But that, you know. Yeah, but I'm delighted to hear you go after the guy because it needs to be done. But like you say, the state of Ohio needs a different capital, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, give me the name of a famous Ohioan.
Well, Grant was born here, but don't tell me Taft. Do I have to say that?
No. Wasn't Sherman originally from Ohio?
Who?
Sherman.
Yeah, old Tecumseh, yeah, he was from Ohio, yeah. In fact, his...
Or, hey, wait a minute, wait, Tecumseh.
There you go. There's a famous American that should get the name. That's a good name. A Native American at that, you know?
Right. Yeah, that would be in the way of righting a wrong, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be it.
I don't think that would qualify as, you know, like, red face.
Well, that's a, you know, well, Kentucky, too. Kentucky was a place where the settlers and the Native Americans met in not very friendly confrontations here and there. And Daniel Boone was there, and you were Booneboro. Yeah. I'm glad you opened the show that way, but it's about time that some, you know, I've heard a lot of that today from people, just telling the truth about Mr. Columbus. And, he was deep in the hole. Didn't he have to borrow the money from Queen Isabella in order to make the cruise?
Yeah, and Isabella and Ferdinand were a couple of vicious, religiously insane, megalomaniacal bigots in their own right.
Yeah, they were driving Islamic and Jewish people out of Spain. Spain's had a problem, huh? Except the one guy, isn't he still dead? The guy that was the dictator for so many years in Spain, Adolf Hitler's buddy.
Yep.
That was a Saturday Night Live line. They'd say, you know, he's still dead. Because there was always, when he was dying, there was these constant blurbs about him. Why can't I think of his name? Something's all in my memory, but I was starting to bother me. The dictator of Spain after the Spanish Civil War. What the hell was his name?
Franco?
Yeah, Francisco Franco, sure. And they would run that line Saturday Night Live, the comic, and he'd be doing the news, and they announced that he's still dead. Because that guy was, he was there from, well, and he bailed out on his buddy Hitler. He did not, because the Germans wanted Gibraltar, and you know what Gibraltar is.
Sure.
If you understand that, and Gibraltar was the Germans would love to get their hands on that mess. I just finished a book that somebody sent me on World War II, and the fascinating part of it was the chapter after the war ended, and my God, Bob, there were refugees all over that continent that didn't know where to go. And in fact, I worked with a guy who was young, 27, 28, when I was 16. He was a Schwabian German, which means he had lived somewhere outside of continental Germany, you know, and the people, of course, kicked all the Germans the hell out, and somehow or other he was a refugee here. Nice, a good chess player. But it was, you know, the country was in a, I mean, even our country was a state of God knows whatism. I mean, things like Kennedy's assassination and Lyndon Johnson, who did an awful lot of good for this country, but he couldn't keep hands out of the military adventure. He saw himself as another Franklin Roosevelt in a lot of ways. And he did.
Well, I mean, that's one of those that's kind of tough, Bill, because in the wake of the Kennedy assassination, it's hard to say what Johnson knew and didn't know.
Yep.
And so consequently, yeah, I mean, you know, Kennedy was on the way out of Vietnam, and then he gets dead.
Yes, that was the bottom line. It was the so-called, what Ike talked about, the military-industrial complex, and I think Ike knew what he was talking about. God knows he had been at the tip of the iceberg in Europe. I don't think Ike ever learned that in combat in his life. Here he was, supreme commander of the Allies in the West, you know. And he actually did a pretty fair job. He had a balance. When you had a guy in Montgomery on one side and Patton on the other, get out the scale to balance the egos of people.
I was sitting on the plane on the flight from Atlanta to New York on Friday, next to a woman who was reading Bill O'Reilly's Killing Patton, and I just thought, oh no.
Oh God, yeah. How can I read that? How can that guy hold a job? Just disgust you after a while. People like that.
Well, Bill O'Reilly has a job for the same reason P.T. Barnum had a successful circus, Bill.
Yeah. Well, at least P.T. Barnum had a sign that this way to the egress. And people would say, oh, let's go see the egress. And they'd find themselves outside, you know. It's a pretty good way of handling people, isn't it? But, yeah, the whole bunch. I remember when I first heard all that, I started, you know, how it is you start rubbing your ears and saying, did that guy just say that? Because then you, I mean, I haven't watched Fox, and I haven't seen or heard. Although there's a sports talk show here in Cleveland, a network that runs, well, they run the Indians and the Cavaliers games, and they've got a couple of guys there. They also run the Fat Man in the afternoon. And the guy before him is the other idiot, the drunk from, I'm a nice guy tonight, huh? You know what I mean by the drunk psychotic that's on early in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a whole bunch of them, it just gets crazier and crazier. And after a while, you start slapping yourself upside the head and saying, clear your brains, man. Because this stuff will go on forever if we let it. Yes, you know, I don't know what the... My luck is I won't have to put up with this for too much longer, you know. I'm going to congratulate the phones, and I'm going to let somebody else use them. But, I never knew what happened to Burr, and I didn't know what it was about until you told the story tonight. I thought it might have been about political power.
Some of it was.
Some of it had something to do with a bank, a national bank?
No. No, that's up in Jack. That's up. That's Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, Jacksonian.
Yeah.
Yeah. And up Stonewall, he's the other one. The other Jackson. This country, we got you. You know, except the one thing I'll tell you, you're being a Scotsman. Did you ever look at the list of Civil War leaders who had MC to start their name? McClellan, McDowell, McPherson, and on and on, you know. Did you probably read the book Born Fighting?
Yes.
It goes with a territory, you know. And he talked about the Blair House, the shooting of the Blair House. Old man Blair was a retired senator. One of his kids was a commander and a corps commander in one of the Union enemies, I think. But, yeah, old man Blair was really out of power, but he had something going. Him and Lincoln seemed to have a pretty decent, I think he was actually I don't want to call him a pro-war Republican. He was a pro-Union Republican. There was quite a few of those guys who were still, they were Democrat, rather. They were Democrats, which, you know, the South was the Democratic Party of the Confederacy were all Democrats, you know. Because what was the Republican Party? When did it come along? 1856 was the first time they ran somebody for president?
Thereabouts, yeah.
And Lincoln was next. Anyway, I'll let you go and clear the lines for somebody here. You take care.
All right, you
Thanks
be good,
for
Bill.
Getting them back, Bob.
Oh, hey, it's a pleasure. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland on the brand new Gizmo line. And, yeah, it'll take a while tweaking the settings on this thing, but we'll get it right in short order. It's a matter of the game to the channel and the gain on the buttons and the knobs, but we will. Meanwhile, let's run over to the Skype line, because we can do that now. Hey, Jeremy. Oh, Jeremy. Jeremy. I know you're there. I heard you breathing. Jeremy.
Do you hear me?
I got you. Or I had you. You're all break up. You're all. Wait, Jeremy, you're all break up-y.
Okay.
So we'll maybe we'll get Jeremy back in a moment. Let's try the gizmo line again. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Yourself?
Oh, reasonably well, I guess.
Trying to gain you up here a little bit.
Okay.
There we go. Yeah, much better.
5x5?
Yep, 5x5. Rocking and rolling.
Good. Yeah, pursuant to your references about Cristobal Colon, yeah, I've never even really referred to that particular holiday as Columbus Day. I've always referred to it as Indigenous Americans Day.
I think it should be renamed such, officially.
Oh, I used to put that on all my calendars and stuff like that when I worked at Fort Jackson. Sometimes we'd have to put out, calendars, upcoming events, duties, stuff like that. And I would always put that on there. And, strangely enough, nobody really ever questioned me about it.
I think most people, Jim, know now that the Columbus story was largely a manufactured publicity myth. And you know, you from your long experience in D.C., far longer than mine, know exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about that horrible piece of statuary out in front of Union Station.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
I mean, you got some representation of Columbus standing up there in his funny hat or whatever, and you've got this cowering, kneeling native at his feet, and it's just disgusting.
Well, certainly not in the very best of taste. Columbus was quite a interesting critter. I know he stole maps from the Vatican, and the maps were drawn by a guy named Toscanelli. But they were slightly bit off because, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm referring to what I learned in a graduate course, Expansion into the New World, that if Columbus' stolen maps are correct, Tokyo, Japan would be where Nashville, Tennessee is now.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. That was one of the things professors used to laugh about. And how many voyages did he make? Four?
I think, yeah, because he wound up, you know, he went all the way to the Central American coast.
Well, you know, but he was so determined that he had found the way to the Orient that he even named a mountain range in South America, still called, I think, today, the Chinese Mountains.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. He was expecting at every turn and nook and cranny to run into the Great Khan or whatever.
When, in fact, he was perpetrating the Great Khan.
Well, yeah, he was. And
sorry, I couldn't resist, Jim.
Oh, no problem here. I have the same opinion of Columbus that you do. And, but like I say, he was just a person who was so determined that he was right and he was going to find all this, that, and the other, but he never quite did it.
But, I mean, let's be very clear. His motives, Jim, were commercial.
Well, of course, they all were. I mean, what do you think Ferdinand and Isabella were looking for?
Yeah. Because they had just spent a fortune persecuting the Jews and the Muslims.
Well, the conversos and people like that. And plus the fact that one of the Borgia post Alexander VI, I think by the Treaty of Tordesillas, had divided the world between Spain and Portugal.
Right, the so-called line of demarcation.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that centers in the plot line of that magnificent movie, The Mission. Jeremy Irons, Robert De Niro.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
Very young Liam Neeson.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen that, actually. But strangely enough, they still call it Columbus Day, and it's not only a state holiday, it's a federal holiday. And, you know, that's, I guess, what they're going to continue to call it lots of other names they could call it by if they wanted to honor an Italian. They could call it Enrico Fermi Day. They could call it any number of days, actually, by many other names. But I still like indigenous.
And, I think that's the direction to go in.
Bob, I've used that for 30 years.
And, I like the little impromptu I came up with, we came up with just talking to Bill there. I like the idea of renaming Columbus, Ohio, Tecumseh, Ohio.
Well, that's just, one bad habit is as good as another. Well, whatever you want to call it, I think you find some problems with that. But nonetheless, you know how names do stick.
Well, I'm trying to come up with a phrase, but yeah, the ability of bad ideas to hang around like a bad penny.
Oh, well, they seem to stick around, and sometimes, as we've quoted before from Chinatown, how they do gain an aura of respectability. Old buildings, politicians, and whores.
Yep.
Oh, you were mentioning Franco. I thought it interesting. Hitler was trying to get Franco to come in on his side, I guess because he needed to get to Gibraltar and this, that, and the other. But Franco was a fool. I mean, he may have been a blackguard, whatever you want to call him, but he and Hitler were supposed to meet at a place called Hendaye or Hinde. And Hitler's train had already pulled up, and Franco kept him waiting. And there's a newsreel I've seen of Hitler walking down and up and down the station platform. He'd removed his gloves, and he was slapping his gloves in his hand, and he was really obviously pissed off. And so when they finally met, they had their meeting. And, of course, Adolf did not get his way. And after the meeting, it said, rather than go through that again, I'd rather have 6 teeth pulled. So Franco obviously knew his way around the playing ground and knew that he couldn't be sucked into that.
What year was that, Jim?
Hitler met Franco in roughly, it was after France fell, it could have been the fall of 1940, but he was, beginning to assume the zenith of his successes and things of that nature, and he thought that he could snooker Franco into...
Well, Franco had already gotten what he wanted.
Oh, yeah. I mean, through the Condor Legion and everything like that in the Spanish Civil War, and, of course, Hitler had endowed Franco with a lot of hardware and troops and stuff like that. And, of course, Hitler wanted to test out his new weapons. And so did Goering. He was a Luftwaffe and stuff like that. They wanted to see how these things would work. And basically the Spanish Civil War was considered in Europe to be the dress rehearsal for the Second World War. And and that it was. It was a very bad time for Spain on both sides. And there were a lot of innocent people killed. I mean, Picasso, in his painting his abstract of Guernica, that town that was just mercilessly bombed by the Condor Legion.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was the Condor Legion that transported Franco and the Nationalists from Morocco into Spain. So Uncle Adolf didn't quite get what he wanted for his money. Whereas, on the other hand, when Stalin helped the Republicans, first thing he did was take all their gold. He took the Spanish, the Republican Spanish gold reserves and had them transported to Moscow before he would give them any help whatsoever.
Yeah, for safekeeping, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, the Stalin Bank. It was a great place to put your money in.
Indeed, indeed.
It sure was. but I can still see those newsreels with old Uncle Adolf just pacing up and down that platform. He was really fit to be tied.
Well, I'm going to have to go and find that newsreel footage after the program, Jim. You've got me intrigued now.
And he had removed his gloves, and he was just slapping them in his hand and slapping them in his hand. And
oh, God, I think I've seen that, the way you describe it, yeah.
Probably looking at his watch. I've never seen a watch on Hitler's hand. Not that I've looked at his hand. Well, I used to look at his hand to see evidence of that he was a Parkinsonian, but nonetheless, yeah. But he really went through a real bad time there. And like I said before, he said he'd rather have a number of teeth removed than having to deal with Franco. Franco lived a long time. And, you know, he was, he was quite a...
He lived long enough to become the punchline of a Chevy Chase joke in the mid-70s.
He died in 1975.
Yeah.
And he has a tremendous thing built there. Oh, that's something you ought to see.
There's that huge, what is it, the memorial to the fallen heroes or something?
Oh, and this was like a mountain almost. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah, it is. And there's controversy surrounding it in Spain to this day because it's a great big memorial to fascism.
Oh, yeah. And he, of course, was kept in power and kept things straight over there with his group called the Guardia Civil.
Yeah.
And Bob, those were people you don't want to mess with. I can tell you that right now.
Oh, no doubt.
Pretty rough people. And, you know, there was an incident there when an American sailor was drunk and in some type of sports car had collided with a donkey. This is when I was in Madrid. Anyway, basically, he ran into a wagon drawn by horses. And the Guardia Civil just took this guy out with their machine guns right there in the street. They didn't mess around one bit.
Yeah, well, it was Hemingway touches on it in his writing. There is reference. I mean, I guess in his later years, toward the end of his life, Hemingway even had a hard time getting back into Spain. He wanted to go, you know, see the bulls one more time.
Yeah. I know that Hemingway and, of course, Ava Gardner and people like that love to have their afternoons with the bullfights. That's something I did not want to see and did not go to see. That was just too much for me. Too much for me. Hell, I remember staying in a hotel in Madrid, and it was like being half finished and stuff like that. And at the end of the hall, of course, you know, you had a communal bathroom. And at the end of the hall was just this black cloth that was draped off the end of the building. And there was no door, but if you pushed that black cloth that was hanging over that companionway, you'd have gone down six floors.
By the way, Carol just provided a little background information for us. The meeting that you referred to was at Hendaye on October 23rd, 1940.
That's why I said Hendaye.
You were right at it.
Well, particularly with that particular area of history, I try to be because it's, you know, something in which I'm greatly interested in. Thank you, Carol, for verify what I said, actually. And but I'll tell you, one of the most interesting places you'll ever visit in Spain is about 30 clicks out of Madrid. It's the Escorial.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
That is something that is absolutely incredible. I mean, truly, it is the Catholic Church envisioned in stone. A beautiful place. And it's where Philip II spent his last days. And when it was first opened in the 16th century, from all accounts, each building had what they call a luminaria in the window. And it said that you could even almost see the glow from the Escorial, from people who lived in Madrid. But you talk about some beautiful things and a beautiful church, and it was built on the shape of a gridiron to honor St. Lawrence. That's how the building was constructed.
Yeah, I'm looking at a photograph of it now.
Right, and of course St. Lawrence was a saint who was roasted on a griddle.
And yeah, there's no end of gory endings for those saints, is there? Of course, and of course, as we talk about so-called Columbus Day, it's worth noting that the Escorial was largely financed with gold and silver from the New World. It was literally built from the blood of the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere.
Well, yeah, of course, and of course, Spain was doing okay as long as that gold lasted, but it did nothing for the Spanish economy.
No, in fact, they wrecked the world economy by flooding the world with Western hemispheric gold and silver. They devalued their own precious metal.
And like I say, it did not develop the Spanish economy because they had this artificial source of wealth that was coming in from the Indies or the Spanish conquest. And it sort of let them, after their day in the sun, to be a third-rate power. And but there it is. But like I say, Spain is a beautiful country, and it definitely is rich in a lot of history, and the Escorial is something that one should see, because in that particular building, regardless of the source of the wealth that built it, it is something there that remains to be seen for anyone who's lucky enough to be able to get into it and see it, and has and of course, you know, there's a pantheon there. The kings of Spain are buried there.
Yes.
Charles V, Philip II, and their successors and things of that nature. But nonetheless, that's, I guess, the end of our little travelogue here as far as, number one, opinions of Columbus and namesakes for his name day, and then, of course, Spain and what happened to Spain since then.
Indeed. Well, welcome to the new Gizmo line, Jim, and look forward to us talking again soon.
Take care.
All right. Be well. Bye now. Our buddy Jim calling from not too terribly awfully far from here. By the way, for those who would like to know more about exactly what happened with the colonization of the Western Hemisphere, there is a dandy good book out by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. It's called An Indigenous People's History of the United States. The blurb for it says, in An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Dunbar Ortiz adroitly challenges the founding myth of the United States and shows how policy against the indigenous peoples was colonialist and designed to seize the territories of the original inhabitants, displacing or eliminating them. And as Dunbar Ortiz reveals, this policy was praised in popular culture through writers like James Fenimore Cooper and Walt Whitman, and in the highest offices of government and the military. Shockingly, as the genocidal policy reached its zenith under President Andrew Jackson, its ruthlessness was best articulated by U.S. Army General Thomas S. Jessup, who in 1836 wrote of the Seminoles, "The country can be rid of them only by exterminating them." Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Might be, well, I know it would be worth the read. Let's see if we've got Jeremy back. You there, Jeremy? Jeremy. Huh. We're connected in everything. Jeremy. Okay. Well, maybe we'll get Jeremy on yet. Of course, both lines are open. All three, technically. Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. Telephonically, 304-574-8178. And on the new Gizmo Horn line, 304-663-HORN, H-O-R-N, 304-663-4676. And lots more... lots more morans to go through this evening. All right, let's try once more with Jeremy, with feeling. Hey, welcome to the program, Jeremy.
Can you hear me now, Bob?
I gotcha.
Oh, well, that was weird. Maybe it's my phone or some sort of... Maybe it's a regular phone line, because I could hear you just fine.
That's strange.
Well, I will tell you, I mentioned last week that one of our local CBS affiliates, who's right-leaning, to say the least, they had mentioned Amumia Amu Jamal several times last week.
Oh, really?
And slandered him, yes. Well, and on Wednesday, they topped it off with a story about Pennsylvania, saying Pennsylvania is in the midst of trying to pass a law that no convicted killers can give commencement speeches at their colleges, because they were so offended at this. So that happened. And then Thursday night, while you were sleeping, preparing to leave Friday, this same CBS affiliate stepped in it big time. There was a school teacher here in Vermont that was killed last year, the year before, named Melissa Jenkins. She was killed by a little, a trollish couple in northern Vermont. Well, they were covering the trial of this gruesome twosome, and for a full 5 seconds, Lord knows where they got it, on the screen on the news, they put up a nude picture of the woman that was killed floating dead in the river where they dumped her body.
Oh, God.
So the goddess of irony is always on duty, always waiting for that time to strike back. Even though it's ghoulish, I do feel some form of retaliation by the goddess of irony.
You know, that's like, I'm taking some physical therapy right now for a problem with my neck. And I walked into the place where I do it, and lo and behold, there's a couple of old fellas on the treadmills in there. And what have they got on the TV? Fox. And lo and behold, you know, I've talked about this before, and maybe I'm just sensitized to it, but I had another one of those moments of religious right-wing privilege, because there we are, and they got Fox blaring away, and of course, the Fox News TV Radio Rwanda is doing everything in its power to terrorize Emery and Eileen and Clyde and Arlie and Marvelline. And the one fellow looks up and says, you know, Bible prophecy says there's going to be a plague that's going to kill off one-third of humanity. Of course, I'm not sure if that's before the rapture or after it. And I looked at him and said, hey, buddy, I'm pretty sure it's before, because it's already happened. It's called the Black Plague. It killed off one-third of the world's population in the Eastern Hemisphere. Oh, that ain't what they's talking about. And I just said, well, I live in reality world. Oh, well.
Yeah,
and so even with that, the guy can't mind his own business. You mean you don't believe the Bible? I said, I no more believe the Bible than I believe the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm. And, I mean, the blood drained out of the dude's face, and he got away from me as fast as he could, like he was waiting for the lightning to strike. But I'm sick of it, Jeremy. I'm not going to sit there and be Bible that and just have to take it. Because, see, that's,
you know, the privilege that these right-wingers exude is that, you know, they can sit there and tell you what you're supposed to believe, and you're just supposed to sit there and be quiet and go, mm-hmm. And I'm getting very close to saying, listen, buddy, you're just crazier than an outhouse rat, aren't you?
Good for you, Bob. Good for you. I probably would have done the exact same thing in that situation. I should mention this affiliate did do their darnest, and they put out a whole little Facebook posting saying they're dearly sorry. And no, they're sorry because it affected their ratings and makes them look bad, but they don't care it happened.
Right. You can't unring a bell.
Right. But, you know, I've also seen this whole Ebola thing is getting out of freaking control, to say the least. I mean, not in terms of it, like, spreading and being some horrible thing, but the news propagandering it and turning it into the next plague, and we're all going to die, and a third of the population is going to get it. And, oh, my God, the medical people that treated the guy who died last week, who came here with it, fully infected, it's going to get everybody. And, I mean, you're probably seeing the postings, too, of the crazy right out there who say things like, the same guy who took away your health care now is going to get you to cause you to have Ebola, too.
You're right.
Blaming Obama for Ebola, like, it's something he injected into these people and they got. And, I mean, the hysteria of close down all the airlines, don't let people in from a different country, lock us in, lock us off, which causes a deeper problem in the wrong end doing that. I mean, we're one of the very few countries that can actually treat this epidemic and have a success rate at maybe even stopping it from killing people.
Although Nigeria is proving quite effective at it.
Yeah, they've actually quarantined off a lot. I heard they're actually doing pretty good at stopping the spread of it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But on an unrelated topic, I thought I'd let you know that most of the schools in Vermont, if not all of them, stopped celebrating Columbus Day. It's no longer a holiday for the students. But there's a positive spin to this. They now celebrate Martin Luther King Day in its place.
In October?
Yeah, no. I mean, they never used to get Martin Luther King Day off on its day. They now celebrate that day instead of today. So they get that day off later in the year in place of Columbus Day.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think indigenous peoples are probably entitled to their own day. What the heck's wrong with the Indigenous Peoples Day, like they're doing in, you know, places like Portland?
No, I totally agree. We probably should do something nationally for them. I'm just saying that in Vermont in general, the schools have taken away that as a holiday for the children, kind of as like a nod to this isn't a true story anymore. And they put it to someone more prominent at this point in terms of, I guess, historic people in recent memory. But, yes, I do think there should be a National Indigenous Day, people. Lord knows we've done enough to them up to this very moment throughout history.
Without a doubt.
But with that, I really have nothing else. Just want to share that little bit of irony and spread the joy. But I kind of – I smirked, but in a ghoulish way, because I was like, wow, that's kind of getting your face rubbed right back in it after you tried to besmirch someone else for so many days.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, have a good night.
All right, you take care, Jeremy. Good talking to you, man.
You too, thanks. Bye.
Right, bye now. Our buddy Jeremy calling from Vermont. So everything is wide open now. 304. Now, okay, some wrinkles here. There's nothing for a line to roll over to. We've just got more lines. So 304-574-8178 is one. The other is 304-663-HORN, 4676. And Bob Kincaid Horn, Skype to Skype. All of them work equally well. You know, Carol pointed out a little bit ago when Bill called, she said, there's a beautiful symmetry to the fact that Mr. Stress was the first gizmo caller. That's just awesome. And I agree. I agree indeed. Moran Monday is upon us, and with an abundance of them. Let's check in with something. Oh, yeah, why not? We know who the Duggars are, right?
Jim Bob Duggar. He's a star of the reality program My Wife's Uterus is a Clown Car. And he is right terribly upset, Mr. Duggar is, because of all them women using them birth control pills. He said when they were young marrieds, they didn't realize that the birth control pill caused abortions. Something we didn't know is that the pill can allow women to get pregnant, but then it can be aborted, and it really, that's what happened with Michelle. She went on the pill after Josh and then got pregnant, and then the pill actually caused a miscarriage. And so that was really when we started examining this. We started looking at the fine print of the contraception, and it said this could happen, and then we talked to a Christian doctor, and he explained this to us. Probably while shaking rattles at them. Scripture says that children are a blessing and gift from God. And we said, God, please forgive us. Scripture says my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, and that's what happened to us. So we ended up giving this area of our life to God, and right after that, God blessed us with twins, and then another one, and another one. Funny, there was no coitus involved, I guess. That was just God a blessing. Matter of fact, we got about 7 or 8, and we thought, what have we done? We got so many children, we didn't know if we could take care of all of them, feed them and everything. It's amazing how God's always provided for us every step of the way. Those little kids grew up to be warriors for the Lord. And so we love going and serving together as family, involved in political races, involved in going to nursing homes and singing and just trying to encourage people in other families. Yeah. No human beings had anything to do with keeping that bunch going. That was all just God a showering the money down on them. No network television executives had anything to do with it either. Unless network television executives are God, right? Sheesh. The stupid is strong with these ones. It really, really is. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
What's up, Bob?
What's happening, Jim? Welcome to the Gizmo Line.
Oh, man. Great to have it back. Yeah, but you were talking about earlier, you kind of mentioned about LBJ and connection. I'm pretty sure he was known as like the senator from the Pentagon. He like had strong connections before he became the VP. And as far as like, there's definitely, I don't know if he definitely knew something was going down. I don't think he was like an active partner, but I'm sure it was, because there was no love lost between LBJ and JFK, and I'm sure it was, pleased as punches, as Humphrey used to say, about, JFK's assassination, but, I think he was just, a passive watcher, they had bigger people wanted JFK out of the picture. Like you said, because right off the bat, JFK had announced that he was going to pull out of Vietnam by 65, or he was planning on it. And they weren't going to let that happen, as far as I know, from what I understand. So,
yeah.
But, that's what I understand. But, also, what you were talking about real quickly, the way people spouting their religious views, like their interpretation of so-called reality and their interpretation of a sky spook, is the one you're supposed to believe. I mean, that does kind of crack me up. It irritates me the same as it does you when people do it. I mean, most of the time I won't say anything, but at work, in my big, my little job, just about everybody knows that, I'm an atheist, and I can, basically, what's weird is, the believers, they don't know squat. I mean, it's like, most Catholics, and these include people in my family, are fairly well educated. I would bet you they don't know jack shit about the Protestant Reformation. All they know is they were baptized Catholic, and I don't think the Catholic Church even teaches anything in their about Protestantism and stuff, because that's kind of a black eye. The whole thing that got Protestantism moving was one of the big things was the indulgences, just the bribes, basically, that the Catholic Church was taking. It wasn't that the main force behind Martin Luther mailing his 95 theses.
Well, that was one of them. The selling of indulgences, the wholesale. Well, it was the wholesale corruption of the church at that point.
That's it. Hasn't changed that much.
But going back to what you mentioned about what I mentioned, the funniest thing is that these fundies go spouting off their views, and most of them aren't grounded in any sort of reality, and they're so shocked when you exercise the same rights that they just did.
Oh yeah.
Because see, they're privileged. You're not.
Right. Well, I mean, they're talking to the sky spook in their head,
Right.
It's known as consciousness to you and me, but to them, they think that's Jesus talking to them. Yeah. I mean, it's like when my mother, she'll go to church, and it's funny to hear them talk about it. I mean, go through it play by play almost, and it's like I didn't see my mother, so I'm not gonna have a question on that. I'm like but I'm curious about asking, well, maybe I hit my sister up about that, because I think she got into it. I mean, you do know about the Protestant Reformation, right? You know anything about that? And I bet you she's a nurse, so she's fairly, she's got a college degree, she's fairly well educated, but almost at $10,000 she doesn't know jack about it. And how do you explain that? How do you explain that little skirmish? Why did Jesus, your Lord and Savior, who knows the Alpha and the Omega, if he knows the Alpha and the Omega, he already knows what's going to happen before it happens, which there ergo means you have no free will. Am I right?
Right. You're just a puppet.
Yeah, that whole free will thing's total bullshit. He knew 10 billion years ago, even though the Earth is 6,000 years old, supposedly, air quotes on that, 10 billion years ago, he was going to create me, make me an atheist, make my life experience, make me an atheist. And I have free will. No, it doesn't work.
There you go.
I just find it kind of funny. But, I just started testing out the new phone line. So everything's going good with the new phone line.
So far, it's just a matter of I'm kind of tweaking as we go and figuring things out.
Yeah. All right, well, I'll let you get to it. I just had to, you kind of tweaked me when you talked about, because that is a favorite gripe of mine with people, whatever version they of the Bible. And the weird thing is there are so many freaking different versions. I mean, you point out the you do realize that there are 3,000 religions or something like that in the world, and then you just happen to be born into the right one.
Try explaining that to one of these folks. It's like hitting yourself in the head with a brick. It feels so good when you stop.
That's it. I'll let you go and get to your phone, and I'll talk to you later.
All right. Take it easy, Jim. Good to hear from you.
I'll let you go.
All right. Bye now. Our buddy Jim calling from, that would be Jim 2 this evening, calling from Louisiana Stan. So the gizmo appears to be working reasonably well. It's just sort of got to be tweaked and engineered on the fly. Let's see. What else this evening? because we've got so many. Let's see. Now we took care of that. Saving that for Wednesday. Little popular culture moment. Granted, it's not high-handed policy or anything, but out in Oklahoma, Stan, Edmond, Oklahoma, Stan, in particular, where Dwayne Dawkins puts up a Halloween display every year. The display includes a tombstone with the name Obama written on it and what appears to be blood dripping from each letter of his name. And for the birth date, it has ?empty space. Nice. Gotta love that First Amendment. Jamila Phillips recently moved to the neighborhood in Edmond, Oklahoma, according to KOCO-TV. And she was deeply, her words, absolutely offended by the Halloween display. He's the president of the United States, and it actually is about respect. It's a total respect thing because this person is still alive. Meanwhile, Dwayne Dawkins says, well, we made him a few years ago back when it was a big deal. Questions up about his birth certificate. And we made all these ourselves, so we just thought it was kind of humorous. And, you know, went ahead and put him up in there as well. There's some skulls and some bones and some plywood coffins. Yeah. They said, I didn't mean to offend anybody. Cause any problems. Don't know I would take it down, though. I mean, yeah. Right, because, you know, it ain't going to be politically correct or nothing, because that, you know, that leads to that Kenyan socialism, right? Back to the gizmo line. Hey, welcome to the program. One moment. We'll get you there. Learning curve for me, too. There we are. Hey, welcome to the gizmo line.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Hey, Kevin. What's that?
Hey, sorry if I called a couple times and hung up. You made me do it a few minutes ago, and I heard the beeps on the program. So I'm imagining you've got some kind of call waiting or something on there. I don't know if you heard the beeps.
Oh, yeah, I hear them. And, yeah. and I guess I've got to call the carrier and say, hey, turn off the call waiting.
Yeah. Oh, well,
or figure out how to do it myself.
Well, you know, there might be a way. I know I can turn off mine, but I don't know how, you know. So, but anyway, I just had to follow up on Jim One's call about Spain and that part of the world. I was lucky enough when I was in the Navy to visit Spain and Portugal both. But what really impressed me back then as a young 21-year-old was their way of life compared to ours. Back then, I don't know if they still do it now, but they had the afternoon siestas.
Love it.
And do what?
Love it. Downright civilized.
Yeah. And, I mean, for a couple hours each day, they close up shop, go home, take a nap, whatever. And it just, I remember walking through the city, and it just being so quiet, no hustle and bustle. And this was a big seaport town. It was not a small city. And I just that whole, the whole continent of Europe impressed me overall compared to us because of their history and their way of life. I guess the closest to us would have, that I visited would have been England, and from the capitalist point of view, you know, the way they did things compared to some of the other countries, but I just remember the beauty of Spain and the quietness and sereneness of it, and when Jim was talking about that, it took me back to those days. And, you know, as a young 21-year-old, you're not necessarily looking for a lot of quality.
You're probably looking for one thing more than any other, maybe. Or...
Right, right. But I couldn't help but enjoy it. You know, when I was in the middle of it, it was like, I'm just going to go over here and sit on this park bench and enjoy the quiet. And I did. And those were the good qualities of being in service. Back then, I didn't really have to worry about a war somewhere back in the early 80s, like the kids of today. Like, I would never tell a young man of today that it's a good alternative to go join the service, because you might just find yourself being shipped off to Iraq, Iran, somewhere where you don't want to be. And back then, I didn't have that worry. I mean, you are in the service. You are called to possibly give your life for your country, but back then, it wasn't real high on my worry list, I guess you'd say. So, and the other thing I wanted to comment about is what Jeremy was talking about, because I've encountered that here in our state, too. The just propagandization of a relatively simple, what should be non-political story and how it's turned around. And I want to ask you this, Bob. And I'll ask the whole Horn family this. Maybe you can't answer it on Monday, but by Friday, I'm hoping to get a little feedback on this question. Compare the Democratic ads for the various races and the Republican ads. And I'm here in my state. The Democratic ad, I swear they're trying to lose the election. The ads do not have any persuasion in there at all compared to what the Republicans are running. I don't know how to put it into words. I just think they're really crappy ads. I mean, they're awful compared to the Republican ones. And I'm wondering if that's something that's just relative to Colorado. Or is that something that's happening all over? Because I'm extremely concerned, scared, that we're going to end up with a Bob Beaupreis for governor. And I don't want that. But Van Hickenlooper is no liberal, but he's certainly better than Beaupreis.
Oh, without a doubt. But see... I like you, I can't speak for the rest of the country, but this is the problem with campaigning, sort of contrary to your base.
Because in
West Virginia and Kentucky, people who are running as Democrats have to run as Democrats, but they, because of the rampant racism in this state, for instance, you have to run away from President Obama at the same time. I mean, I'm Democrat and everything, but, you know, that Obama and his EPA war on coal, I'm so sick of it. I'm puked of it, Kevin. I am. And frankly, after if there's a silver lining to be had, maybe, and I'm certainly not, you know, hoping it happens, but if it's as much a bloodletting, figuratively speaking, as it is predicted to be, then there will be an opportunity to redefine what it means to be a Democrat.
Yes.
And maybe in a state like West Virginia, we will finally figure out that the way to be a Democrat is not to try to be a slightly less nuts Republican. You know, there
exactly.
are the 60% or more of the people in West Virginia despise mountaintop removal.
Yep.
And yet there's not a two-party candidate, either a Democrat or a Republican, who's acknowledging that.
We can't get them to acknowledge the science. We can't get them to acknowledge the health crisis. We can't get them to acknowledge the existence of the future.
Yep.
Well, if the ass kicking is what a lot of people think it's going to be, come the morning after the election in the Democratic Party in a state like West Virginia, it's going to be hell among the yearlings.
Well, yeah, except that the pain that that will inflict upon millions of people is something I don't want to see. Because I guarantee if Bob Beaupreis becomes our governor, I'm getting eat. I mean, you know, you talk about the $1.10 a day for food stamps. That's going to go down to about 50 cents a day for food stamps, if I'm lucky. And
don't eat it all in one place.
Do what?
Don't eat it all in one place.
Right. Don't eat it all in one week. You know, I mean, it's just, and I don't know if you're familiar with this Beaupreis character, but some of the things he said, he's to the right of your average teabagger to begin with, and he's actually going to hold an office of governor. I wouldn't have that man as the county animal control officer, much less governor, just for the fact of some of these outlandish statements he's made that just contradict reality. And this by his, Colorado is by no means a red state. If you add up all the Democrat voters and all the Republican governors on a population basis, we're not red. We're just not. Colorado Springs may be, but the state of Colorado is not. And yet, I look at these ads that have come out for both Senate and governor, and I'm like, if I didn't know who to vote for, and I just voted on the basis of these ads, the Republicans are winning that hands down, in my opinion. Because they're not identifying themselves as Republican. You know, they're running ads based on appealing to people's emotions. And upon, of course, fear. You know, that's a big one. But I hate to say it, but they're just doing a better job in reaching the average voter. And it disgusts me because it's a failure of the leadership of the Democratic Party nationally and statewide. In this state, I volunteered for the party and not gotten phone calls back from them. And I just gave up. If I volunteer, if I put my name in to volunteer for this, that, and the other, and you can't even call me back, well, not my problem, you know?
Right.
And so you lose an engaged voter who would have been willing to work for you. But at this point, I think, like a lot of us in the Warren family, have checked out a party, whatever party that may be, and have come to realize that liberal and or progressive does not mean Democrat. It means we are liberal and progressive. That does not define us
well,
by party.
But I would submit, Kevin, that it can mean that, but the problem lies in not insisting that that be how we define ourselves. Does that make
right.
sense?
Yes. Yeah.
I know a lot of people want to go do third party stuff, and I'm all for it. You know, go ahead, enjoy yourselves. Don't be thinking that you're going to see anybody get elected anytime soon.
Right.
But we have seen, and I'm not trying to piss anybody off. I'm really not. But we've seen that major parties can be refocused and redirected.
Sure.
But I guess we're not very good at it.
So instead of trying to drive the Democratic Party in a more progressive direction, we'll just go do our own thing. And I understand that. I completely, you know, there are places in this country where third party challengers may very well wreck the hopes of people who otherwise plan to, you know, be part of a new Republican majority in the Senate.
Yep.
The libertarian in North Carolina comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And isn't there a libertarian running for Senate in Colorado who's drawing some numbers?
No, for everything I hear, the race is a toss-up between Gardner and Udall. I haven't heard about any third-party candidate myself.
Well, there's a couple of other ones out there that that I know of. North Carolina is the only one that comes to mind. But look, I mean, and I suppose it's possible. Well, no, I mean, here in West Virginia, Natalie Tennant's going to lose all by herself with no help whatsoever. But there's a third-party Mountain Party candidate, Bob Henry Baber, nice guy. I've had Ed Rabel on the program here, and I fully support Ed Rabel's candidacy in the 2nd District congressional race in West Virginia because, frankly, Nick Casey is as useless as tits on a boar.
Yep.
When it comes to issues that actually matter to West Virginians. You know, like being able to go on being alive West Virginians instead of headstones.
Right.
You know, he's another one of that crowd that won't acknowledge the science.
Right. Yep. Well, not to mention, when you listen to Ed Rabel, you realize the guy's got a little bit of intelligence behind him the moment he opens his mouth. You know, I mean, he's not just the next newsman from CBS. On any given issue, Ed Rabel knows what he's talking about. But there's an awful lot of people in this country, Bob, that are perfectly content to not be informed on issues and to let someone else tell them what to know or believe or think. And that is a lot of what I see as the problem. And I think, like you're talking about, if it is that big a bloodletting for the Democratic Party in this year's election, then we'll learn from history once again, sort of. But 4 years from now, when we've learned our lesson and take back the Senate and the House, will we once again go back to what we unlearned? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I see happening right now, is we learned those lessons 4-8 years ago. We just haven't followed them. Had we followed them, I don't think this election would be close for the Republicans whatsoever, but we have.
Oh, you also, Kevin. You also have to factor in all the voter suppression attempts that are going on.
Oh yeah, but again, that's almost sometimes because the vast majority of people don't want to know that there's voter suppression going on. You know that I don't know. It bothers me sometimes that people do not want to even learn what real truth is. And sometimes real truth is something far greater than what you want to believe. Yeah, like you often determine that. There's a difference between belief and science, kind of thing. Same thing. You know, you've heard about this, well, you did a segment on it a while back, the suppression of history out here by the Jesco School Board. regarding history and how they're just wanting to rewrite history. And I don't know if you've seen some of that, but it's the only thing I can word I can use for it is amazing. They're actually rewriting history, things that we've known for hundreds of years to be fact.
Yeah.
And they want to rewrite it as, no, that didn't happen that way. You know?
I mean,
so, but at least we have had some people stand up to that. I'm proud to say the younger generation, kids that are just graduating high school, stood up to that and said no. And that does encourage me, because the younger generation is what's going to determine what happens in the next 50 years long after we're dead and gone. And so I am encouraged by seeing that. But I'm extremely concerned for this election. And you're right, the voter suppression that's happening is outright illegal in some places, but people have got to stand up to it, and there's not enough of that going on, I guess is a good way to say it.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, it's good to hear from you, and I'm glad you got through on the Gizmo line.
Yeah, sounds good. So.
All right, you have a good evening.
All right, take care, bud.
All right, bye now. Everybody, Kevin, calling in from Colorado Springs. You know, I want to thank you again, because this is none of my doing. I want to thank all of you again for putting the Gizmo line in place. The technology was not cheap, but you stepped up to make it happen, so that people could have more forms of access to the program and to the conversation and to the community itself. And I can't adequately express how much that means. It's pretty profound. Thanks also to Sal. Sal and Carol together have comprised the fundraising for this evening. And we are about $140 away from our evening's fundraising goal. I'm sure they welcome any company they can get in trying to keep things going. Let's go back to the Gizmo line. Hey, welcome to the broadcast.
Is it me?
That's you.
Hi, Bob. It's been a while. This is Steve from New York.
Hey, Steve.
I just want to be very clear here. Far be it for me to ever defend the church.
Yeah.
Okay. I've had plenty of issues with the church, but there's one thing I can't stand is including Catholicism in with the fundy evangelical Protestantism, and I'll tell you why. Particularly this whole young earth crap and the teaching on the sexual teachings and all that. Number one, the church is not one of these young earth, it's only 6,000 years old. That's not teaching.
No, to the church's credit, they kind of got over, they tried to get over that with the apology for what they did to Galileo.
I mean, the father of the Big Bang was a Jesuit priest. He was a Belgian Jesuit priest named Georges Lemaître, and he got in extensive arguments with Einstein about the Big Bang, about whether or not the universe was ever expanding or whether the universe was static, because Einstein was initially of the opinion that it was static, and this little Jesuit priest convinced him that he was wrong, and Einstein eventually came around to it, which is something I didn't know. And again, I don't want this to come across as I'm not being built.
No, I understand. And this is not me saying, you know, some of my friends are Jesuits or anything, but some of the smartest people I know, period, are the recipients of Jesuit educations. There's no getting around the academic rigor.
Yeah. I mean, I have arguments, and I have friends of mine who are priests who are quite gay, and they're quite open about it. And we have a GLBT group at my church who has the support of the entire parish, has the support of our pastor, who gives, we have events that get advertised in the bulletin. We get events that are advertised from the pulpit. We have the pastor advertises these things from the pulpit. So, and all in New York where we have a nutball as a cardinal. And I have, I don't want to get into it, but I have plenty of things that I know about past cardinals that things are never what they seem.
Well, yeah, and the fact of the matter is it does look like with some of this stuff that's got, and I'm not an apologist, okay? I'm non-religious. You know that, Steve. But by the same token, I have to acknowledge with some hope the attempts at reform that are being slowly, and I think it kind of has to happen slowly, attempted by Pope Francis. You know, the guys try it. And you know, for instance, just with the discussion taking place now about the gay community and the divorce community.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to make the likes of William Donahue's head explode.
And great. Yeah. I would pay to see that on film.
You know, my advice to Pope Francis, not that he sought it or anything, would be stay off small aircraft. Have two food tasters instead of one. But the fact that he's trying, I mean, he's getting busy. He's trying to replace some of John Paul II's ultra-conservative proto-fascist cardinals with arguably more humane ones. None of this is with regard to doctrine and dogma, and nobody's ever going to come up with a Christianity that is going to be tolerable to me because I actually studied it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's like the Fundy Goober who was talking about, you know, a third of the people going to die off in the tribulation. You know, that's when God dumps a bunch of tribbles on us. There's our Star Trek reference for the evening. But
I didn't spell that.
Tribulation, that's T-R-I-B-B-L-U-A-S-H-U-N, tribulation. But I agree in part, but sometimes, now, some of this stuff you can lump in with the fundies. There are places where the two, you know, where the two little circles in the Venn diagram overlap. I remember when Agnes and I were going to reconsecrate our vows on, I think, our 10th wedding anniversary, and we were informed by a Baptist minister that, by God, he couldn't do it. You know, because Agnes done had one of them divorces. And some of that stuff is just, and so look, you know, there's one of those places where the Venn diagram circles overlap. And you know, meanwhile, you also have to take into account, Steve, the weirdos. The people who reject Vatican II. I mean, Vatican II was what, 1961?
Yeah,
and they reject it.
Well,
and yeah. you've got at least, I think, four members of Opus Dei sitting on the Supreme Court, and that's a lay order that was founded by a fascist priest, who is now a saint thanks to John Paul II. I mean,
I just want people to be clear. I'm not here to defend. But what bugs me is when people say things that aren't true. Like when people say, like, the teachings, for instance, the teaching on homosexuality, the church's teaching has nothing to do with the Bible on that. Nothing.
No, that's just ancient bigotry.
It comes from the teaching of, now I'm not defending this, it has its origins in St. Augustine and the whole notion of natural law, and
yeah.
That, and not to put too fine a point on it, but it's not confined to homosexual, I hate saying homosexual people, to gay people. It's any sexual act that does not lead to procreation falls on that other side of being against natural law. And I just, and I find too.
Well, and I find the idea. I find the idea of natural law just sort of silly and
silly. Yeah, I think it's silly too. I think it's silly too.
And it's silly. It's silly whether Mike Huckabee's arguing it or whether some ultra conservative Roman Catholic is. Hey, Steve, I hate to do it, but I got to get out of here. We are running.
Geez,
right
I didn't realize the time.
Well, you know, it does fly away on us.
Yes, it does. But it's good to talk to you. I'm glad you're doing well. I was one real quick. I was able to see one of the MSNBC segments. I don't have cable, and I actually was glad to see it.
Well, the segment's up there on my Facebook page. It's been posted and reposted if you want to go and find it. I just enjoyed the heck out of the experience. One of these days I'll get to New York with enough time that we'll have a horn hangout.
Oh, I would love to have a horn hangout. Okay, go spend time with Agnes and the kids.
All right, see you, Steve.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. Steve calling from New York. It is time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the Horn chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan and Carol. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks very much to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACAC, ACHEACT.ORG. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.